You're listening to the ISACA podcast. In this Knowledge Series podcast, we're speaking with Phil Zongo, author of the ISACA Journal Volume 4 article, The Promises and Jeopardies of Blockchain Technology. In this podcast, we're discussing blockchain technology, its benefits, and the challenges that it can pose. So to begin, can you talk a little bit about what blockchain technology is?
I'll start a little bit by giving a brief background of the blockchain technology. And I think as you are aware that this concept started back in 2008 when a mysterious character called Satoshi Nakamoto published a fascinating paper that was a precursor to the invention of the Bitcoin technology, which has now become maybe blockchain's most successful implementation to date. So basically, the blockchain technology is the underlying technology that powers Bitcoin and several other cryptocurrencies. And I would say, unlike traditional systems, blockchains are widely distributed across several computers interconnected across the world. They are not reliant on centralized servers like we use in the current business environment. The key differentiator with blockchain is the ability to build concurrent or logical blocks one on top of the other using strong cryptographic algorithms, which are able to validate and append transactions to previous blocks, making it very hard for anyone to reverse any transaction. So they come with them, they bring with them a high degree of authenticity, non-repudiation, and to some extent, as some experts call, immutability, but we'll talk about it a little bit later. The key issue that blockchain are going to fundamentally change the way we do business is by removing the middlemen and a lot of other back office operations and bringing in two parties to directly transact without the need of a central guaranteeing authority. They eliminate a lot of inefficiencies and they also lower transaction costs. So I think since 2008, the use of blockchain has grown beyond its original intent. It was originally intended to power Bitcoin, and improve efficiencies within the financial services sector, but now we've seen its use cases extend much beyond the original scope. So industries like healthcare, remittances, even manufacturing, they are starting to run proof of concepts which are based on the blockchain technology. And I anticipate that over the next few years, we are going to see much broader implementations beyond the original scope.
And you already touched on this a little bit, but what are some other industries that are using or could use blockchain technology?
Like I said previously, the most successful implementation to date is the use of cryptocurrencies. You know, if you look into the Ethereum protocol, for example, which is being used by a number of enterprises to develop what are called smart contracts, which are basically self-executing digital arrangements. So I'll give an example. Say if you buy a car on a loan and you've got your obligations to repay maybe $100 every month for the next 5 years, under the concept of a smart contract, if you say you're supposed to make payment on the 15th of every month and you default, this arrangement will quickly come into force, and you won't be able to access the car. It will lock itself. So these are some of the concepts that are being trialed within the financial services sector. For me, I do have a use case that's very close to home. So I live here in Australia, and every month I send money to my parents who live in rural Zimbabwe, which means I need to use one of the money transfer organizations such as Western Union or MoneyGram. For me to use Western Union and send money to Zimbabwe, it means I need to buy US dollars. I need to convert my Australian dollars to US dollars, and I need to go to a Western Union shop, and then they charge me a fee, which is quite a substantial percentage of the money that I'm sending to my parents. And they move that money across different financial service institutions, and my parents will be able to get the money in Zimbabwe. When blockchain comes into force within this industry, it's anticipated to remove the middleman. So pretty much there won't be Western Union anymore, which means if I am sending $100 to my parents, they will receive almost $100 instead of receiving $80 because $20 has been taken by the middleman. So by directly connecting individuals in the in different parts of the world, I think blockchain has got a very important use case of lowering transaction costs and thereby improving the livelihood of those that are in need. And I think the same concept applies to the humanitarian needs as well. So when people donate money to people in third world countries, a significant portion of that money is taken by the middlemen. So blockchain will eliminate all those redundancies and ensuring that, you know, donations reach their intended recipient. So there's quite a number of use cases, but I think the remittance one is much closer to myself.
How are digital currencies regulated, and in your opinion, are there sufficient regulations in place?
I think that's a very important question. So when I wrote my article that was published recently, one of the key risks that I highlighted was the fragmented nature of global regulations around digital currencies. And over the last maybe couple of years, mostly last year, we saw a number of jurisdictions come up with positions relating to how they expect digital currencies to operate. And I think we saw countries like China and Hong Kong, they outlawed initial coin offerings altogether within their jurisdictions. Other countries, such as here in Australia, Switzerland, and in the USA, the governments have come up with positions saying, providing guidelines where initial coin offerings are deemed a security, which means that if they are deemed a security, they have to comply with a whole range of regulations that were established over many years. Other countries like Nigeria, which is one of the largest economies in Africa, they have distanced themselves from the regulation of cryptocurrencies, saying, you know, it is like the internet. We're not responsible for creating digital currencies, so we are not going to be regulating them. And inevitably, this has created a number of loopholes that are putting investors in serious harm's way, because we're seeing millions and millions, if not billions of dollars, being invested in digital currencies. And with these fragmented regulations, it means that if things really go wrong, there is very little recourse for someone to get their money back. So if I invest my money with a bank here in Australia, there is a lot of regulations, there are government guarantees, there's quite a number of laws in place to protect my investments. And without similar arrangements within digital currencies, which actually work across several jurisdictions because of the wide reach of the internet, it means I can invest in a cryptocurrency that is located maybe in Russia or maybe in South Africa, but there's very little likelihood that if things go wrong in those countries, the local regulations here will be able to protect me. So I think we are seeing governments starting to pay some attention to this important domain, but I think the responses are still very fragmented and are not very, they're not very convincing at the moment.
Why might a regulatory sandbox for initial coin offerings be useful?
Yeah, I think that's an important point as well, because I think the positions that were taken by countries such as China and Hong Kong to outlaw initial coin offerings altogether, in my own opinion, it might be a little bit too harsh and maybe imprudent, because as a number of experts have rightfully argued, initial coin offerings themselves, if they are harnessed correctly, they can provide a viable means for entities to access, you know, capital that would otherwise find it very difficult to access capital to fund their projects, especially most of the organizations that are raising money using this method are, you know, they're funding imaginary ideas. So they don't have a lot of precedent to go out to established banks and raise money. So they provide some viable alternatives for organizations to raise money. So allowing them to operate in a regulatory sandbox, like what the regulators in Quebec in Canada have done, I think it's an important step to, you know, give regulators enough time to come up with pragmatic regulations. You know, you need to come up with regulations that don't stifle innovation, but that also protect innovators, and that takes time. So I think instead of just saying we don't want digital currencies to operate within our jurisdiction, regulators need to take a more pragmatic approach to say, why can't we, you know, maybe limit the amount of money they can raise in a regulatory sandbox and not really kill this viable offering. So I think that's a very noble approach to say, let's see what these things can do, but let's also, you know, keep a close eye, because, you know, we don't want things to go wrong and damage economies.
When people talk about blockchain, they often talk about its immutability, but you call this a myth. Why is it a myth, and what are some of the impacts of believing this myth?
That's an important point, because whenever I go to speak at conferences or I interact with colleagues in the industry or I read a lot of white papers, one of the key characteristics about Bitcoin is, you know, its immutability. To say, once transactions are digitally time-stamped and appended to the distributed ledger, they cannot be reversed. And I think that is a dangerous position to take, because if you look back over the last 5 years, we have had quite a number of high-profile data breaches or scams that affected digital currencies. Back in 2014, I think one of the largest Bitcoin exchanges, which was based in Tokyo in Japan, called Mt. Gox, was hacked, and investors lost almost $500 million as a result of that. And a closer look indicated that, you know, Mt. Gox had similar issues that we have had for the last many decades. You know, it was an insider threat. Someone had exploited in the vulnerabilities within the organization and possibly stolen some funds. The company also had some poor version control, and you know, basically they had no governance frameworks in place to insulate themselves. Just about a year ago, we had another high-profile breach as well back in Japan. Another organization called CoinCheck, which lost about $500 million as well. And this CoinCheck was established without multi-signature, which is your equivalent to multi-factor authentication in the modern-day world. And they also stored these high-value transactions using a concept called hot wallet, which means they were directly connected to the internet and anyone could, you know, access them and possibly hack them. So my point is, given the high-profile breaches that we see every day, exploiting common vulnerabilities that we have had for quite some time, I think the claim of immutability is actually providing a false sense of security. I think there is considerable merit. Blockchain has got very strong security controls around it, you know, strong cryptographic algorithms, decentralized architecture as well. But the key problem is those features can also provide a false sense of security to enterprises.
What considerations should enterprises make when thinking about adopting blockchain technology?
I think there are maybe two fundamental things to say. By nature, when you adopt blockchains, they are going to replace a number of systems that have been operating for years. And some of these systems actually still underpin very profitable business lines. So the key thing is to have a well-thought strategy to say, you know, which systems can we cost-effectively replace with blockchains and without impacting business resiliency? Because I think if you just go without thinking, carefully thinking about, you know, how are we running our business at the moment? You know, which systems can we replace with blockchain? You are likely going to cause some tension between, you know, innovation and business resiliency. You might break things that have been working for years. So you need to take a step back and, you know, maybe profile your digital landscape to say, if we start with this core piece of a business process and we experiment with blockchain using a limited set of business process, you know, once we are comfortable regarding how that works, then you can expand the scope. The other issue as well relates to skills, to say, for you to develop well-functioning blockchain, you also need skilled programmers who can develop this program. So do you want to develop that capability in-house, or you want to outsource it to an enterprise that has demonstrated capability in other institutions? So I think there's two things you need to carefully think about: which systems are ripe for replacement with blockchain, and do we have sufficient skills to develop those capabilities? Do we want to do that in-house, or we want to outsource it?
Can you discuss culture and how it may affect blockchain adoption? What might happen to enterprises that refuse to consider blockchain or other disruptive technologies?
That's maybe one of the fundamental areas. And this is not unique to blockchain. It's maybe an issue that pertains to digital transformation as a whole. Whenever you want to make some aggressive movements, you know, the issue relating to blockchain, I think as time goes on, a lot of enterprises will realize that it's not a nice to have. They have to adapt, because if your competitors are adopting, you know, modern digital trends that are fundamentally changing the way they interact with their customers, lowering transaction costs and creating more money for innovative products, you have to follow suit, you know. So enterprises that resist the change, I think they will slowly become irrelevant to their customers. And like I said, this is beyond blockchain. It's about all disruptive trends, machine learning, Internet of Things, and a lot of other disruptive trends. So I think, like any other transformational program, by replacing things that have worked for decades with new processes and new ways of working, it means you also need to change the established mindset, because, you know, the people who've been running these back office reconciliation processes, remittances, and a lot of other things that blockchain will render obsolete in the next few years, they will inevitably resist change. So I think you need a wider cultural change program to say, you know, which areas are going to be replaced by blockchain, and how can we effectively redeploy those resources within the enterprise? Because if someone has been doing something for 20 years and you're going to replace that process, it means that the experience that they have accumulated over that long period of time can definitely be repurposed for something very worthwhile within the organization. So I think, you know, cultural change is something that every organization has to carefully see, because if you don't have a strong communication program, it's very likely that people are going to resist the change, because they feel like they're going to lose their jobs. They feel like you are forcing them to retrain. You know, people don't want to retrain after doing something for a long period of time. So you need a very strong cultural change program that are ideally driven from the top, you know, from the CEO down the ranks, and cascade that message consistently across the enterprise.
And finally, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I would maybe say in conclusion, you know, blockchain is maybe one of the most transformative digital trends that is anticipated to change the way we interact with our customers, the way we live over the next few years. And like I said, these disruptive trends are no longer a nice to have. You know, every enterprise needs to have a well-thought business strategy that's presented to the board of directors, that has got a strong buy-in from the top, and, you know, that's got a strong buy-in from the wider business community as well. So I think this all comes back to strategy. Enterprises need to baseline what they're doing now, understand what are the emerging trends that are going to fundamentally change what we offer to our customers over the next few years, and then prioritize, because, you know, the pace at which digital transformation is happening is very fast. So attempting to adopt every trend can also just, you know, lead to noise. So you need to carefully think to say, you know, there's machine learning, there's cloud computing, there's Internet of Things, there's blockchain, all these digital trends. Which ones really matter to our strategy? How can we align this to our corporate strategy and to what our customers need? And I think us as risk professionals have got a key part to play as well. We need to upskill ourselves and be able to act as trusted advisors to business leaders, rather than just say, you know, you can't do this because it's risky. And in as much as I highlighted a number of risk issues relating to blockchain, I think the benefits far much outweigh the risks, and it all comes back to a well-thought business strategy.
Thanks, Phil. And that's all we have time for in this edition of the podcast. If you're interested in learning more about blockchain's benefits and challenges, check out Phil's Journal Volume 4 article, The Promises and Jeopardies of Blockchain Technology.